My name is Jared Altick, and I'm a chaplain with the police department. You're listening to a bonus episode of Hey Chaplain. Hey Chaplain is the police wellness podcast, and although we normally focus on interviews with police officers, today we're talking to Brandy Fisher, a sexual assault victims advocate with an organization in Kansas City called MOXA. Part of Brandy's job is going into police academies to teach officers about sexual assault and the impact of trauma on a victim. She has a lot of really good coaching on what to do and what not to do when talking to a victim, but she also has some really fantastic insights on when and why a rape victim might be lying or telling you the truth. Here's Brandy Fisher. Hello, Brandy. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad you're here today. Well, I was eager. You came highly recommended. And I said, you know, send me somebody who can really talk about this. And They said, oh, let me send you Brandy Fisher. And so I'm glad you're here. Tell me a little bit about MOXA. What is that organization?
Okay. So MOXA is the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. So in the early 70s, a local coalition of criminal justice folks, health professionals, mental health professionals, and just other professionals and actually survivors in the community came together to figure out how to build some type of organization that can help survivors of sexual violence.
And this was primarily in Kansas City, Missouri?
Yeah, it was KC metro area. Okay. Yeah, there was a need. They saw a need to help survivors who had been experiencing sexual violence because there wasn't anything at all in the KC metro community.
Okay.
And then in 1975 is when MOXA was created. When we were first created, we offered our crisis line advocacy and counseling services. So that's kind of primarily what we did in the beginning.
It seems really advanced for the 1970s.
Yeah.
I'm surprised, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it was like pretty common. That's when kind of some of the domestic violence agencies were starting to come about, like where people would have a house and they would let people, survivors of domestic violence, come stay at their house.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of that feminist movement of of those things.
Right.
Like we have to support these people who are being harmed. So it was, there was a lot of that happening in that time period.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Kansas City is actually a large metro area that straddles the state line between Kansas and Missouri. And so a lot of people don't even realize there's two Kansas cities. And so when we say Kansas City, most of the time, Kansas City Chiefs, Kansas City Royals, we're talking about Kansas City, Missouri. But there's also a Kansas City, Kansas. And then there's several other cities across, five or six counties that make up the Kansas City metro. And MOXA is serving sexual assault victims in both sides of the state line.
Yes.
And in all of those counties, plus a little extra, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It's interesting because we're in Jackson County, which is where Kansas City, Missouri is, and it's a huge metropolitan area. And then we're in Cass County, which is very rural. So we are adjusting even our advocacy when we're going out into places like that, because it's just a different
from true like urban core to rural farmland. I mean, there's the whole you get the whole spectrum.
Yes.
Yeah. And lots of suburbs in between and everything. Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. So you were telling me before we started that you're actually like really proud of MOXA.
I am. And we're actually now the largest rape crisis center in the United States.
Oh, wow.
And we're actually celebrating our 50th anniversary next year. So 2025 will have been around for 50 years.
What's a rape victim's first interaction with police?
So they walk into the ER. They say, I've experienced sexual violence. I was sexually assaulted, whatever. The hospital staff will put them in a room and they'll call a SANE, a sexual assault nurse examiner. And they'll do what we call the rape kit. They'll They do the exam for the rape kit, which is evidence collection. Mm-hmm. And the nurse will ask, we also, a MOXA advocate, will be there. Like they call, the nurses call us automatically. So we go sit in the room with the survivor during the exam.
Okay.
And then the advocate, the nurse we'll have conversations with the survivor. Do you want to make a police report? If they say yes, then the nurse calls the whatever police jurisdiction where the crime happened.
Right.
They call them, and then we just wait for them to come out, and they'll take the report in the hospital.
Usually get a uniformed officer or a detective?
Most of the time, it's a uniform officer. Okay. Every once in a while, a detective will come out if it's, like, serious injury or, okay. like, there's something bad that happened.
Right.
Or... like sometimes, like if it was witnessed, you know, like a detective okay. will come out.
If they have more to work with from a legal point of view, they might send a detective. Otherwise, you've got yeah. a uniformed officer that's coming out to take a report. Mm-hmm. How does that go? And let me ask specifically, how does that go wrong?
It goes wrong when an officer walks into the room, doesn't sit down. Like, we can always find another chair. Like, the, you know, hospital rooms are small, so...
So, a big, tall officer walks in and stands, looms like, over the victim.
Literally. I mean, I've seen that happen. Like, this big, giant guy walked yeah. in, and it's this little, tiny girl, like...
Yeah.
And he's just standing over her, and I'm like... Yeah. I'm like, please sit down. Like, just being eye level with people, because it's the power, right? Like...
Yeah.
Sexual violence is about power and control. That yep. it's not about sex. It's not about
yeah.
attraction, anything yeah. like
it's
that.
About it's intimidation about intimidation and manipulation. And,
right.
Yeah.
Controlling somebody else, having power over somebody else. Well, police already have that power, right? Yeah. Like they are
the literally, enforcers. Literally carrying a gun.
Right. They're, in, they're yeah. enforcers of the law. That's yeah. their job. So they're walking into the room with this like... just power, any way you can like lessen that is going to make the survivor feel calmer.
Like sitting down.
Sitting down, saying I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry this happened to you.
So you're sympathizing?
Yeah, you're like giving, you're turning your empathy on.
Yeah.
Really is what we want. We want that empathy where you're trying to like understand how hurtful this was for that other person
and connect.
Yeah, yeah. And making that connection, introduce yourself. Most police do that, but every once in a while, you know, you kind of get in a hurry and
you gotta be careful too. If you're introducing yourself, not to bark it at them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm officer so-and-so.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Just, yeah. yeah. I always say like walk in the room and put your bias away, put your judgments away, and then soften yourself. Because that's what I have to tell myself, too. Like, Brandy, be soft. Because sometimes I'm not. So that's yeah. that's how I think about it a lot.
Yeah. For an officer, that's just another call for service.
Mm-hmm.
But for the victim, this is life-changing,
yeah.
traumatic experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first time they do the report... And the victim is typically asked to describe what happened, give some kind of timeline.
Mm-hmm.
What goes wrong for the victim?
Well, the timeline part is hard because they've experienced trauma. So trauma changes the chemicals in your brain. It affects the way memory is actually stored different during a traumatic event. Mm. Like if you are in a car accident or you see a car accident, and you're going to go tell your, like, if I was going to go tell my husband later that day, to me, that was traumatic. And I'm going to tell the story differently. Like, it's not going to be linear. It's not going, I'm going to be have a hard time recalling the details.
Yeah.
And they do, survivors have that issue. Like, they actually can't remember what happened during the whole entire thing.
Yeah.
So the kind of the way I explain
which only hurts them later when they want to come back and fill in some of those gaps. Now it sounds like the story's changing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But it's not. It's just how memory works after experiencing trauma. And the details are the same. They may just be flipped around. Like maybe they thought the actual assault started earlier than it did, mm-hmm. or, you know, different elements of the assault were in a different order. That doesn't mean people are lying, or if they forget stuff, like if they straight up forget things, that also doesn't
What's
mean that they're lying.
What's an example of something they would forget?
I worked with somebody who, she was at a gas station and somebody ended up getting in her car. And he actually physically assaulted her, like in the parking lot of the gas station. But then he took her somewhere else and raped her. When the police came, she didn't tell him about the rape at all.
Oh, wow.
Because she was just like completely just traumatized. And she's...
So she's able to report, he assaulted me, he beat me up. Mm-hmm. But then she left out the
sexual
part.
And there
was
witnesses because it was at a gas station, like, oh, okay. And it was on video.
So the
like,
first part of the event, but then he takes her to another location.
Yeah, like somewhere totally different. Out. Yeah. She forgot. And we got to the point where we were engaging with prosecution. And she, so this is like, it got charged real fast because it was on video, like the actual physical uh-huh. assault. And that's what they charged was the physical assault. But we were on the phone with the prosecutor and she was like, what about the rape? They were like, we don't know what you're talking about. Mm. Like, she just didn't, she forgot. And yeah. she...
Well, she's coping.
Yeah.
So she's blocking that out. She's not deliberately lying about it. She just can't go there.
No.
And that's part of trauma.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult because cops, one of the main things they're working through any interaction they have with the public mm-hmm. is, well, who's lying to me and how much are they lying? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the answer is everybody. And the other answer is a lot. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they're constantly, you know, disbelieving and distrusting, you mm-hmm. know, most of what they're hearing. Mm-hmm. But when they're going to a victim who is having memory gaps and they're blocking things out because they're not ready to talk about something like that yet. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice to a police officer? How do you manage a case where someone's only giving you bits and pieces mm-hmm. of what you need to know?
Have an advocate. Like, call your advocacy center. If you have one in your area, mm-hmm. like, work with an advocate. That's my biggest, I'm always going to say that. As advocates, we increase the comfort level for survivors. And they're telling us, like, just random bits and pieces as we're engaging with them, different parts of the story yeah. That they haven't told the police. And I'll step in, I'll be like, hey, did you tell the police that? Did you tell the detective that? Or in the moment, you know, when we're making a police report or we're sitting down in a detective interview, I have heard a lot of the story from the survivor and I'll be like, hey, can we take a break and yeah. talk to the survivor and just be like, hey, you told me this. Is that something that you want the police to know? Because they do need to know that.
Mm-hmm. What is your job with MOXA right now?
So I'm a coordinator of advocacy. So I supervise half of the advocacy team. We have 9 advocacy and outreach specialists, and I supervise 5 of them. And then I do still have my own caseload is what we call it. Mm-hmm. So I get paired with survivors, either through the crisis line at the hospital. Sometimes our therapists will refer survivors over to us. I go to court with people, file orders of protection with people.
Go into police interviews.
Police interviews, yep. Detective interviews.
Why did you get into this? And why do you still do it? You said you've been there for 8 years?
Yeah, I've been in this field for 11 years. I did domestic violence advocacy for a few years before
this
I came
like
to
MOXA. This seems like a job where you'd be a lot of secondary trauma, be a high amount of burnout.
Yes.
Why do you do it?
I do it because it's just who I am as a human being. I've always been like this. I've always been like, we got to help these people. We have to help people. And I am not afraid to like say stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was in high school, so I was a senior. My sister was a freshman in high school. One day, it was like in the morning before school started, and she came and she was like, this guy keeps like touching me and hitting on me and like saying inappropriate things to me. And I was like, that is not happening. So I like flew off. He was in band. So I flew off into the band room and I was like, you need to stop. This is inappropriate. And I was like, it's just unacceptable and you need to stop. I don't want to ever see it happen again.
You're an advocate at a young age.
I've always been like that because I'm like, people deserve to have support and to feel good and in their world.
What was it like when you began? What was it like first time you sit down with a rape survivor?
It's hard. It's hard to hear their stories.
How did it make you feel?
I mean, it's sad. You know, it's sad, but it's also, I also feel proud that, like, they trust me and that they allow me to be part of their life.
Do you have any idea how many individuals you've helped over the years?
Oh, I don't. A lot.
Dozens? Hundreds?
Probably hundreds, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a day of the week that is more common to see people report sexual assaults? Are they?
It's so up in the air.
It's not like a Monday morning after the weekend kind of thing.
It's weird how.
Is there a seasonal time?
Summer is always busier because people are out and about, you know, out in the community, out drinking. I mean,
yeah.
Alcohol is the number one drug used to facilitate sexual violence.
Yeah.
During the summer, people are just out at the bars, whatever, doing things. And so, yeah, it definitely gets
busier.
So maybe
is there a time of day that you get more calls?
Not really. It's funny. Last year was our busiest year ever in the history of MOXA for hospital advocacy, where we go to the hospital. And before last year happened, you know, we kind of slowed down after summer. And then last year it was just like a total anomaly where it was just like, we were so busy through the winter, through the, you know, during seasons where we're not as busy, we were just like solid busy. Any choice we can give them, we're going to give them.
Okay.
As an advocate, I talk to them the pros and cons of everything. So here's the pros, here's the cons of making a police report. And some of those are that a lot of these cases don't get prosecuted. And so you're going through this whole process, you're telling your story in detail over and over and over again, and then they just never, either the case doesn't get picked up, like the prosecutor doesn't charge, or they do, it goes to trial and juries don't believe survivors really at all. And so they're, you know, found not guilty and there's no justice. Like, people want justice because that's the way our world is set up, is to, when a crime happens to you, you get justice through the criminal justice system. And a lot of these survivors don't. It's sad. It's kind of a negative. It's like a downer. I'm like, oh, I'm a big downer right now. But we have to tell people that. We have to tell them the pros and the cons.
In your estimation, just, you know, your opinion, what percentage of rape survivors have their attacker prosecuted successfully?
Oh, it's like less than like 2% or something. It's like...
like 1 out of 50.
Oh, it's less than that.
Okay. You believe it's less than 1 out of 50 successfully prosecuted?
Oh, definitely. I've been at MOXA for 8 years. I think I've had less than 5 people charged.
So if somebody is worried, like, oh, yeah, but what if this woman is making this up and she's lying about it? I mean, that's certainly a risk, but the truth is, the number of people who go to prison for raping someone is a tiny, tiny percentage of the actual rapes that occur.
Right. And those people that are raping other people, there's very few of them. But the people who they do it, they're like 63% of offenders are serial offenders. Mm. So they're doing it over.
Multiple victims, multiple times.
Right. Just over and over and over again. And that's part of that cycle within the criminal justice system. Like, we don't believe this victim, or we do, or we're not acting very well when we're engaging with them, like from law enforcement, you know, not sitting down, not softening, not using all those tools, not understanding trauma. the victims know that, and then they pull back and they're like, I don't want to move forward with this.
And how commonly do the victims personally know their attackers?
It's like 3/4 of acts of sexual violence are committed by somebody that the survivor knows.
Okay.
So the stranger danger thing is like
stranger getting you in a parking lot. It happens, but it's really rare.
It's
compared to.
Yeah, it for sure happens.
Sure.
It's absolutely something that happens.
Sure.
Most survivors know the person, like maybe it's an ex or a current. I mean, you can be raped by your husband. You can be in a relationship like that and they can rape you,
but it's more likely to be somebody that they know.
Yeah maybe somebody they see in class
creates more complications with, do they go to the police, do they pursue this? Okay.
It's harder to find consent in that way. You know, if you're in a relationship with this person and you've had sex before, well, you did that before, so you must have wanted it or whatever. Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Okay, so one of the things you do is you go into police academies and teach. You teach recruits, you teach officers, like they're doing like CIT training. What is the biggest takeaway? If you go in there and spend an afternoon teaching them all this stuff, what's like the main takeaway? What's the one or two things that are really important for police officers to know?
To understand trauma, like that's a huge deal, and how it affects your memory, how those responses, fight, flight, or freeze, are automatic. It's your like lizard brain, I guess, is what people call it. Like
it's happening at an instinctual level.
Right. Like at a level that we can't control. Like we cannot control that. One of the things about freeze, right? Like you're frozen. Like you can't actually physically move. So that's something that, you know, sometimes police will get hung up on.
Why didn't you run
away?
Why
didn't you fight back?
Yeah.
Well, I actually couldn't fight back. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen or that they wanted it to happen. It just means that they couldn't. Trauma. That's what trauma does. Yeah. And the other thing I really try to like focus on is like the concept of like start by believing. So you're walking into the room. I mean, most of the time, you know, you're responding to some type of like sexual assault, like, or something like that. Like you can prepare, like, I'm getting ready to do this type of call. So you're walking in the room, you're putting your bias away, you're putting your judgments away, and you're softening yourself. And you're just like, I'm going to believe them. And then when you get in the room, like sit down, introduce yourself, say you're sorry. Like say, I'm sorry we had to meet this way, or I'm sorry this happened to you. It's really, or you can just say, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like it doesn't matter how you say it. It is so important for survivors to hear that, because it creates this like sense of like, I'm being believed and they care about me. They actually care about me and that I was hurt. Like they're trying to help me. Yeah. And that's what police are around for. They're to help us.
To the police officers listening right now, what's the one thing you have to stress?
Advocacy. Like having an advocate available to people is really important. And
you felt like you had to stress that, right?
Yeah. I do have to stress that. It's just, it changes everything.
It leads to more prosecutions? It leads to what?
Yeah, I think it, when you have a survivor who's really into the process and wants to provide every bit of information they can and wants to be available through the criminal justice process, having an advocate there is going to help that along, because we increase that comfort level. They are more likely to follow through.
Cops develop an instinct about who's lying to them, and that doesn't always serve them well.
Yeah.
What do you say to a cop who's looking at a victim and he's just like, I just don't think she's telling the truth? He's got little red flags that are going up. And he may or may not be right, but what do you say to him?
I would say, check yourself. Check yourself. Where is that coming from? Because it's probably coming from somewhere. Most survivors don't lie. It just doesn't happen very often. They say that about like maybe 7% of survivors of sexual violence lie about what happened. And that's kind of in line with any other type of crime. There's always going to be people who aren't being honest about what happened.
Right. There's a small percentage.
I have theories about all that, just personal,
your personal opinion
that I have developed as an advocate. Some of my favorite detectives that I've worked with, they're like, why do you just believe everybody? And I'm like, because that's my job. And and I know, I've been doing this work for so long, I know, and I see it, people just don't lie about this. You know, they do back out. A lot of the times I was at a training years ago and a chief of police was in the training and he was challenging me on believing people. And I called him out and I was like, the reason that people aren't following through and aren't coming back is because of your attitude. I was like, I've noticed your all's attitude in this training. It was a day long training. I was like, you guys have an attitude about not believing survivors. People know that, like, survivors are in tune. Even if you don't say it out loud, they're in tune with your body language.
They're picking up that they're not getting anywhere, and so they just bail.
Yeah. And they're like, well, they're uncooperative. Well, that's on you, to be honest. Like, most of that is on you and how you were treating them. So detective-wise, some of the best detectives that I've ever worked with, you know, they come in, they introduce themselves, and then they just say, tell me what happened in your own words, however you want to do it. It's just very open-ended. And then they just sit there and listen and they take notes. And then they go back after the survivor's done talking and kind of fill in those gaps that maybe the survivor missed. And it's kind of the same with initial reports, you know, when they're just making that first report to an officer, like not asking a lot of questions, letting the survivor tell you what happened in their own words, sitting down, like if a survivor goes to the police station, don't take the report in the lobby of the police station. Like, even if there's nobody there, don't do it.
Give them some privacy.
Every police department has at least a room. I mean, even some of them will take them into the inner, like regular interview rooms. That's fine.
How much of a disadvantage is it if a detective's a big, tall, scary-looking male versus a female? Can a male detective overcome that?
Yeah, people ask that all the time, and I'm just like, most police officers are male, like, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's just what it is.
Yeah.
People know that, like, the whole world knows that, right? Like, I haven't met anybody who isn't like, oh, I know I'm going to get a female police officer. Like, we all know that. Survivors know that. They know that if they want to make a police report, the chances that it's going to be a man is high. It's, again, it's that, like, softening yourself. You could be the biggest, hugest person, but if you're sitting down, you're kind of more at their level.
Yeah.
Just, you know, breathing a little bit before you go in, and just, it's a human thing. Like, we're connecting in a human way. We do that outside of our jobs all the time. That's what this is. You're connecting with them as a human. You're just taking a report. And the detective's job is to talk to them later, get more details, and then investigate it and figure out what happened or how it happened.
Brandy, thank you so much for coming in today. It's such an important thing that you do, and I love that you partner with police to help them understand their role in it a little bit better.
Thank you.
I want to thank Brandy for coming in and talking to me, especially when she was fighting a really bad cough, and she just soldiered through and really gave me some really great content, and I really, really appreciate her making the sacrifice. I want to give a shout out to our CIT officer, Philip Mathis. He was the first one to suggest Brandy as a guest for our show. Thank you, Mathis. This show exists because many of you pitch in to help. Learn more in the show notes. The views expressed here are the personal views of the host and our guest and do not necessarily represent the views of any law enforcement agency or its components. If you like this episode, please share it with a cop or someone who loves a cop. Thank you for listening to Hey Chaplain, and as always, pray for peace in our city.